Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. The end of San Francisco, at least according to our guest, described as a provocative, angry, queer, anti-assimilationist writer who tells me she's fine with the term flaming faggot. She's also been described by the Austin Chronicle as a cross between Tinkerbell and a honky Malcolm X with a queer agenda. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore has been on Out in the Bay before, once reading from her novel So Many Ways to Sleep Badly, a stream of consciousness romp through the sleep-deprived life of a tenderloin sex worker that pokes fun at NPR, Bikram Yoga, and the travesties of post-gay San Francisco. And early last year with Harris Kornstein, a.k.a. Little Miss Hot Mess, a contributor to the queer anti-assimilationist anthology she edited, Why Are Faggots So Afraid of Faggots? Now she's back to shake us up some more with her latest manifesto or memoir. It's called The End of San Francisco, and in it, Matilda deals with family, incest, gay sex work, the digital ruination of our city by the bay, political correctness, and much more. Stick around for what we hope is, in Matilda's words, another delicious discussion about life, struggles, and triumphs, ours and the cities we live in. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, welcome back to Out in the Bay.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to see you again. So I didn't quite finish reading the whole The End of San Francisco, but I'm looking forward to reading the rest of it. And what I've read so far, there is so much in The End of San Francisco. So why did you write it, and why it's been called a memoir? Why did you write it at the age of, if I do the math right, you turned 40 sometime this year?
It's true. Sometime this year I turned that corner, and I can't wait.
39 is a drag. 40 is fine.
Well, finally I can say, oh, remember when that happened 20 years ago? And it doesn't even seem like that long ago. So, you know, this book, in a way, it's about my formations and their undoing. So politically, socially, sexually, emotionally, ethically. And as I started to write it, you know, it ends up sort of circling around my most formative times in San Francisco. So I first moved here in the early 90s when I was 19, and I was searching for other radical queer outcasts and freaks and visionaries and dropouts and, you know, sex workers and sluts and vegans and anarchists and all sorts of other people sort of escaping who we were supposed to be, the sort of suffocation of childhood and our parents and the world around us. And we were coming to San Francisco to figure out ways to cope, ways to find other people like ourselves, ways to challenge the violence of the world around us, whether that be straight or gay normalcy, and ways to figure out, you know, new visions of lust and love and intimacy and direct action and troublemaking, you know, on our own terms.
So what... For you specifically, what were you escaping from when you came to San Francisco? And did you come here from, you came here from where?
Well, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I grew up in an upper middle class assimilated Jewish family where the violence of my parents was camouflaged by their outward success. So I was sexually abused by my father, and as a child, I sort of put that all into my body, you know. So I didn't remember it actually until my first close sexual relationship was when I first moved to San Francisco.
Yeah, and there's a passage describing this in the book.
Absolutely,
did read that part.
Yes. Yeah. And so, you know, because I was living in a culture that talked about rape, you know, that talked about violence, that talked about, you know, our parents and what we didn't want to be, I finally had enough safety to sort of feel it in my body. And I started having these flashbacks and remembered that I was sexually abused. And it was such a gift in a way to live in this kind of culture, you know, in the mission of radical freaks and outsiders and queers. A lot of us, you know, were sexually abused as kids, you know, or physically abused or emotionally abused by our parents. And so it was, you know, a sort of common discourse to kind of talk about that abuse and try to figure out ways to not repeat it in our own lives and, you know, to become something else, you know, something more flamboyant and transformative and, you know, healing and hopeful than the world that we had grown up with.
Sort of a flamboyant response to rage. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I think so. Or using rage as a starting point for challenging the violence of the world around us. So I think, you know, so often in a sort of gay mainstream identity, it's about becoming part of the dominant culture without changing anything you know, about it, right? And so for me and the people around me and coming to San Francisco was really part of rejecting that whole world. You know, I didn't want any part of it. I didn't want to be part of, you know, this dominant culture. It'd be part of what was considered family or, you know, or now what people are obsessed with, marriage and military and, you know, priesthood, you know, all of that, organized religion, the nuclear family. You know, I just wanted to throw it all in the trash and create something else. And those are still the values I believe in. Mm-hmm.
Do you you have a passage or two to read for us? So
sure,
you want
absolutely.
To start off with one?
Yeah, I'd love to. Let me take one sip of water.
Of course.
So I'm going to read from a little bit of the part. It's actually the chapter that's called The End of San Francisco, because, of course, in the book called The End of San Francisco, there's a chapter called The End of San Francisco. Each chapter, in a way, is its own ending. But this is a chapter about moving to San Francisco in the early 90s. I'm going to read from the middle of the chapter. We were scarred and broken and brutalized, but determined to create something else, something we could live with, something we could call home or healing or even just help. I need help here. Can you help? We were incest survivors, dropouts, whores, runaways, vegans, anarchists, drug addicts, sluts, activists, and freaks, trying not to disappear. We paraded down the streets in bold and ragged clothes, too big or too small. We shared thrift store treasures and recipes and strategies for getting Dayglow hair to last. We exchanged books and zines and flyers and gossip, got in dramatic fights over politics, over the weather, over clothing, over who was sleeping with whom. We held each other. We painted each other's nails and we broke down. Honey, we broke down. We were the first generation of queers to grow up knowing that desire meant AIDS, meant death. And so it made sense that when we got away from the other death, the one that meant marriage and a house in the suburbs, a lifetime of brutality both interior and exterior, and call this success, or keep trying for more brutality. But when we got away, it made sense that everywhere people were dying of AIDS and drug addiction and suicide, because we had always imagined death. Some of the dead were among us, just like us, just trying to survive. Others were more in the distance, the elders we barely got to know except as we lost them. We went crazy and cried a lot, or went crazy and stopped crying. Or just went crazy. We believed it was us against them. They were straight people. They were abusers. They were rapists and landlords and cops. They were parents and politicians and anyone with designer clothes. They were the gay people who congregated in the Castro, apathetic, straight-acting gay men who went to the gym and dressed like clones in white t-shirts and baseball caps, gay men who hated women and fat people and people of color and sissies and anyone who was different, really. And we were different. We were absolutely certain of that.
Very nice. That is, excuse me, Matilda Bernstein Sycamore reading from her memoir, published April 15th by City Lights, The End of San Francisco. You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. That you mentioned, you know, being the first generation to be here and kind of realize that intimacy meant AIDS, meant death. And you later became, or was it earlier, you became quite involved in ACT UP, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. When I first moved to San Francisco, I think being queer, you know, in a radical way meant that you were part of ACT UP in a certain way. And so I found ACT UP, and it was really inspiring because ACT UP at that time in San Francisco focused around universal health care, around needle exchange, around prisoners with AIDS, and around women with HIV and AIDS. And so it was an ACT UP that said that in order to challenge, you know, in order to help people with AIDS, you had to fight racism and classism and homophobia, that it was all sort of intrinsic to queer struggle. And so that was where I really learned from, you know, activists that in many cases were 20, 30 years older than me, who had long histories of sort of challenging the violence of the status quo, whether that be structural homophobia or whether that be familial violence or whether that be interpersonal violence or whether that be the violence of, you know, endless U.S. wars or U.S. militarism. And some of these people had been involved in activism for generations. And it was a really incredible, it was sort of my formation as a queer person and an activist. I already had sort of an activist formation, but it was where I was able to sort of tie my queerness into activism in a way that they couldn't be separated.
The book also talks, this might seem like a little bit of a jump, but talks about, you know, in your, some of the groups you went to New York and you lived there for a while and were also involved in many groups there. You had a protest that blocked the Brooklyn Bridge for a while and one at Brown University where you took over the administration, right? The administration building. And you talk about process, all the process in these groups. And I'm wondering why there is, you know, process seems to bog things down, and there's this political correctness that stifled communication for you. You mentioned that in the book. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because I really believe in process, you know, in a certain way. And I think the kind of cultures that I came of age in, you know, when I first moved to San Francisco, it was sort of all about process. You know, it was about trying to figure things out. And so relationships were about revealing everything about yourself. And then when there was nothing left to reveal, you would just go deeper. And in terms of activism, it meant your analysis had to go deeper, right? So in order to challenge the violence of the world around us, we had to take apart all hierarchies, you know, not just the ones that we were directly fighting. You know, it wasn't about a narrow identity politics. It was about connecting everything, you know, so that all these connections were intrinsic to the struggles we were involved in. I think the problem is that sometimes the way that people engaged in the processes, even in sort of radical queer organizing, still sort of kept the same kind of hierarchical way of thinking, you know? And so people were still, you know, kind of figuring out ways, and this is both interpersonally in relationships as well as specifically in the direct action organizing, but people were still figuring out ways to, you know, win or, you know, beat everyone else in the group, you know, or to sort of camouflage their own violence, you know, through a very kind of sophisticated rhetoric. And I think that happens a lot in San Francisco, where there's this very sophisticated rhetoric in radical queer cultures, but the actual lived experience of figuring out ways, you know, to challenge the violence around us and create something else doesn't happen as much. So there's this very self-congratulatory kind of rhetoric, like we have arrived, you know, we live in the right neighborhood, you know, we don't buy all the terrible things, you know, we make our own food, you know, we, et cetera. And it becomes kind of like a self-congratulatory lifestyle rather than, you know, an actual embodied challenge to status quo normalcy or to consumerism or to, you know, sort of commodification kind of culture.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning there's some point in the book where it talks about, you know, if you didn't have, if your friends all ended up living within a few blocks of you, right? And is this in the Mission District when you lived
exactly,
on Sycamore Street?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, that's funny. Yeah, when I first moved to San Francisco, and I think actually it's ironically, this is 20 years of gentrification later, and I think this the Mission still has that same allure for people as the place where you go to kind of, you know, find yourself as a radical queer person, you know,
and except I think it's too expensive, right?
and but it still has, that's what's so shocking is it still has that allure, you know, even if you're paying, you know, $1,000 for a room instead of, you know, $285, like it's still, people still want to be in that place. You know, it's a really complicated thing. And so in the book, I do sort of talk about these successive waves of gentrification. And I think the scariest thing about gentrification, I mean, obviously there's the displacement, you know, there's the homogenization, there's the ruin of so many like cultures of resistance. But I think even scarier than that, or perhaps part of that, is the way that people lose the ability to imagine something different. So people instead are imagining something that looks different or might, you know, have a different kind of aesthetic or a different way of talking about things, but acts the same. You know, it's the same kind of ruinous kind of consumerism and the sort of like, I need to get what I want and push everyone else away without really thinking through, you know, creating something different.
So I'll just share a little something with my listeners. This is the first time, just before we went on the air, I said, you know, why didn't I ever think of this before? I just put a bunch of flashcards down, wrote things down that I wanted to remember to talk about because I never think of doing that before. So they just kind of got scrambled. So can we talk about sex work for a little bit?
Of course.
Because, you know, after all, we've got...
Well,
yeah, it's like we're half over already. How can that possibly be? Anyway.
Well, it's always so fun.
So, well, how did you happen to get into doing sex work?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the culture that I was a part of, you know, in the early 90s in San Francisco, it was almost... I think what was great about it was that the sort of analysis around people's lives, it made it possible to do something like sex work and to be empowered about it. So for me, sex work was a way to support myself outside of the sort of workaday world and still have time for creating the relationships I wanted, for doing the activism I wanted, and for cultivating, you know, my art and my writing, you know. And so I think I would be a very different person without sex work, you know. And so... You know, I think so. When I first started turning tricks, you know, I took an ad out in the BAR, and it went from there. You know, and I think it was, you know, I supported myself, you know, as a whore for like about 12 or 13 years. So it took a lot of turn, and in many cities, in San Francisco, in New York, in Boston, in Provincetown, and part of it actually enabled me to like move to all these different places, in Seattle as well, and. So I think when I first started working as a whore, I don't know that I knew exactly what I was doing, you know, and so, but I think what it enabled me to do was to actually be in my body more. I think the stereotype is of sort of like, you know, when you're turning a trick, you kind of leave your body and you float on the ceiling. And I started turning tricks after I remembered I was sexually abused. And so I knew that feeling very well of floating on the ceiling.
The feeling of leaving your body.
Exactly. Yeah. And So I didn't want to go there at any cost. And it didn't mean that I didn't go there, but I figured out ways to come back.
Okay.
So I would focus on the sort of the sensation of skin, you know, or something that was turning me on, even if perhaps this person wasn't turning me on, or even if perhaps, you know, the surroundings were really a mess, you know, or if, you know, if the person, you know, was tweaked out and had been up for like 6 days, you know, and I would try to find something about the interaction that actually did turn me on in order to keep me in my body. And
right.
I think sex work in some ways taught me how to be in my body. And I think after like a decade of doing it, you know, it sort of had different, you know, I became so tired of being in basically the people that all my work was against, you know, the sort of like mainstream gay consumer culture were the people that I was in the business of pleasing, you know, and I knew how to do it so well. I would just shift personalities and go into this mode. But I think it just became too tiring, you know, mm-hmm. after so long.
I would think it would be. I dated a guy for a while several years ago who was an escort on the side, and he had a really actually pretty good day job, but he was doing this. He said, oh, I just need to pay off some credit card bills. But I have a feeling there was more to it than that. And eventually he said, well, he felt like it was a way to take a little bit of control back, or he felt somehow worth more because, after all, people are paying me, so I must be worth more. Is that a similar thing for you, or at least was part of it, like feeling of taking some control back over your body after you had been abused as a kid?
Yeah, well, I think that became part of it because that became part of everything that I did, you know, in terms of my life choices, in terms of my activism, in terms of the relationships, you know, that I chose to be around. I mean, I think so it was part of I think I was lucky in the sense that I was part of these kinds of cultures that were dedicated to politicizing everything. And so this became one of the politicized life choices that I made. And so in that sense, it was part of it. I don't know that it directly, you know, that was the goal or the impetus of it, but it did turn out to fit really well into that framework.
Mm-hmm. So you have got some other stuff to read for us,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I can actually read a little bit about the world's oldest profession, as they say.
Okay.
And this is actually from a chapter towards the end of the book called What We Were Creating. And this is about moving back to San Francisco in 2000 at the height of the dot-com years. Although now, of course, we're living in another wave of dot-com years. So, God, I mean, it just gets worse and worse. But here's a little snapshot from 2000. This is from towards the beginning of the chapter, but not right at the beginning. On my rental application, I became a technical writer who made a preposterous amount of money. Everything except my name and social security number was fake. I got lucky and ended up with a studio apartment on the top floor, set back from the street because of a burned-down building next door, facing Polk Street and the sun. Or, okay, maybe I didn't get that lucky. I had to outbid someone to get the lease, but it was the nicest and cheapest place I'd seen. I didn't know about the roaches or the rats or the pigeons yet, but the kitchen was big enough that I could put my bed in the dining area with a screen between sleep and vegetables, which felt luxurious. Certain people thought it was a strange setup. Why did they put the bedroom over there? Of course, my technical writing consisted of giving blowjobs in plush off-white hotel beds while the TV flashed stock prices behind me. I remember one Tuesday night, after my third trick and on my way to a fourth, stepping into the W and finding so many people in the lobby that they spilled into the elevators to make deals on their cell phones, cocktails in hand. Outside the Ritz-Carlton, there was a couple who looked like they couldn't be older than 25, stepping out of a Rolls. The guy was wearing a waistcoat and holding a cigar in one hand and an attaché in the other. The woman was wearing a full-length fur and gold slip-on heels. At least I was making cash. In fact, I was making more than the figure on my rental application. After all, I had become a New York City hooker. No longer would I take the bus to save money or turn down tricks who called when I was hanging out with a friend. I would show up within a half hour in full preppy drag. The tricks loved it. Sometimes they even asked if I was gay.
Oh, I love that. I can't imagine you in preppy drag.
I know,
I'd like
right?
To see that sometime. Show me a photo. that's Matilda Bernstein Sycamore reading from her memoir, The End of San Francisco. Learn more about Matilda and her work at her website, matildabernsteinsycamore.com. And you've got some readings coming up. Next Tuesday?
Absolutely. On Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, I'll be at City Lights at 7 p.m. And then on Thursday...
That's in San Francisco at Columbus and somewhere.
Yeah, Columbus and Broadway.
City Lights. Look it up.
Yes, exactly.
It's an institution.
Exactly. So I'll be there Tuesday, April 30th, 7 p.m. Then 2 days later, I'll be at Pegasus Books on Shattuck in downtown Berkeley. That's Thursday, May 2nd at 7:30. And then on Thursday, May 9th at 7 p.m., I'll be at the GLBT History Museum at Castor and 18.
Okay. I want to ask, what readings have resonated most? You've already started your tour. You were in like Cal State Fullerton. What do people ask you about most, and what readings resonate most with them?
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting is I've been choosing really vulnerable parts to read. And I feel like people really, the conversations after the readings have been really intimate. You know, people have asked really interesting questions. And they've the whole range, you know, people sort of ask about that vulnerability. I think that's very common. You know, people like, why are you drawn to writing these really vulnerable things, to revealing this about yourself, or what does vulnerability mean to you? And I think I've been really drawn, you know, I think as a teenager, I had to create a facade of invulnerability in order to survive. And I think, you know, as a queer kid growing up in a world that wanted me to die or disappear, that invulnerability is really important. And I think now, you know, 20 years later, I think what's important for me is vulnerability, you know? And so I think creating that possibility for having these deep conversations with people that I you know, most of whom I've never met, or some of whom I might have seen at my other readings, and some of whom might be friends, but then most of the people I don't know. And I think people are really moved. And that's been really exciting, because I was a little worried that I would read these really vulnerable parts and then people would ask me about politics only. Mm-hmm. And I want to be asked about politics, but in the context of what I'm actually reading.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And so, and actually, you mentioned Cal State Fullerton. That was an interesting reading because, you know, Cal State Fullerton is in Orange County, and the kinds of questions people asked there were really questions about survival in a certain sense. They were like, how can you articulate things that really challenge people and not be destroyed, you know? And I think, so that was an interesting reading, and I think, but all of the readings have really they've been great in that sense. I'm really looking forward to, because I haven't read yet from this book. It's called The End of San Francisco, and I haven't yet read in San Francisco. So, you know, being at City Lights, you know, next Tuesday, that will be my first taste of San Francisco audience.
And so I have to ask you before we run out of time, why did you leave San Francisco? What became the end of it for you? And are you still in Albuquerque or Santa Fe?
Well, you know, when I first left San Francisco at the end of 2000, I moved to Santa Fe. And it was sort of like I needed to get the hell out of here because I think all the relationships that I had believed in, for the most part, had collapsed, had failed me. And I think that's one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, the relationships that I created, you know, through activism, you know, through desire, you know, through shared politics and, you know, shared visions and accountability and mutuality and negotiation and intimacy and, you know, the politics of desire, the desire of politics, the melding of everything. In many ways, those core relationships had failed me. And I think the one that really hit me the hardest was my closest friend of 16 years. The friend who will, you know, kind of like the friend who will always be there no matter what. And where he stopped talking to me without even telling me. And I thought I was kind of staying here because of that relationship. You know, San Francisco had ceased to inspire me. The worlds that had once given me so much hope just felt like a trap, you know, like loss. All I could think about was loss. And I still appreciated like the beauty of San Francisco and the sort of culture clash of the neighborhood where I lived in the Tenderloin. But I was like, oh, am I just staying here for familiarity? And when I lost that relationship, I felt like, oh, it's now it's time to go. And I've been dealing with, you know, a lot of chronic health problems for years. And I realized, oh, well, I've always lived in big city, moist coastal places. And so I thought, well, let me try the opposite. So I moved to Santa Fe, you know, a mountain town in the desert. And pretty much everything was worse.
Uh-oh.
So I was there a little over a year. I was trying to make it work and see if something would change, but it was not good for my health, and it was so isolating. And Santa Fe, I mean, everywhere I've ever lived is depoliticized, but nothing comes as close to the depoliticization of Santa Fe. Uh-huh. And so after that, I moved to Seattle, where I had lived 96 to 97, but at that time, it was too quiet for me. And but now I like quiet. So I think Seattle is a good balance between, you know, the frenetic kind of energy of, say, somewhere like San Francisco and a sort of quieter place.
Do you think has writing this memoir mellowed you?
I don't know. Is it mellowed me? It's a good question. I got to think about it.
In a minute or less, can you tell me like how, like, and you reflect at all about how it may have changed you, the process of doing this?
Well, one of the things I realized in writing this book is how many times I've believed in the same cultures. That was the thing that most surprised me. I'm like, because I thought, oh, I was over this, you know, in the betrayal of the politics and the cultures and the communities I believed in. That started in 1992, in 1993, and 1994. And that's what I mean, where the book, it's like every chapter is a different kind of ending and a different kind of ending of San Francisco. You know, whether it's about an end of hope for sort of the connection in public sex, or the end of hope in the activism I believed in, or the pageantry of direct action, or the end of hope in specific relationships. And so I think the thing I learned the most was like, oh my God, I keep believing in those same cultures. I don't know what that means. You know, I think some people have described it in reviews and at readings as being hopeful, but sometimes I worry, is it just delusional?
Thank you so much. That's Matilda Bernstein Sycamore. He's been my guest here on Out in the Bay. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. If you missed part of this broadcast, you can hear the whole thing on our website, outinthebay.org. It should be up by 9 o'clock tonight, maybe even by 8:30. You can also sign up there for free podcasts and get the Stitcher app. That's right, Stitcher, that lets you hear radio programs on mobile devices. Before I forget, let me give you Matilda's website again. It's matildabernsteinsycamore.com. Find out all about all of her great books. You can also hear our most recent shows on our site, and now you can also hear about a dozen of our favorites from our 8 years on the air, including interviews with John Waters, Ang Lee, Leslie Gore, Matthew Shepard's mother, Judy Shepard, and a feature on Liberace, even. We've been producing Out of the Bay for more than 8 years. We could use your financial support. You can find the donate button on our website. There are other ways you can also help us out. We don't involve money. We would love people to help us with our tweeting and social, you know, media stuff, because I'm not too good at it, and I need some help. So there's other ways you can help. So check it out, outinthebay.org. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KLW for studio use and airtime. Our theme music was composed and performed by San Francisco musician Holly Ann Mead. Learn more about Holly on her blog, hollymead.tumblr.com. We'd love to hear from you. Oops, I almost forgot. Out in the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org/LRIS or by phone at 415-989-1616. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.